I hope you don't mind if I normally read them. Do you think I should read that or as normal? Okay, since we are so few. Okay, this is my statement. My name is Maina Kiai, and I'm the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Rights to Freedom of Peaceful Assembly and of Association. I would like to once again thank the government of the United Kingdom for inviting me to undertake this official follow-up visit from 18th to 21st April 2016, which is a follow-up to my initial visit in January 2013. This is the first follow-up mission I've conducted during my tenure as Special Rapporteur, and I commend the government for its continued willingness to constructively engage on human rights in general and on the rights to freedom of peaceful assembly and of association in particular. It is clear that the UK takes its role as one of the global leaders in human rights seriously. Many people around the world look to the UK as a model for democracy and human rights. The world notices when this country takes positive steps to strengthen its practice of human rights, but it notices even more when it moves in the opposite direction, restricting the space for democracy and human rights. Let me thank the government for its excellent cooperation in organizing the mission, short as it was. A remarkable number of meetings were set up with members of the executive and legislative branches and independent institutions over the past 4 days. The input and assistance of these officials was extremely helpful. Given the brevity of the visit, I only looked at the situation in England. I would also like to thank the many activists, members of civil society, and other non-governmental interlocutors who took time out of their busy schedules to meet with me. These individuals were a diverse group, coming from many walks of life, working on a diverse range of issues, and hailing from a multitude of different backgrounds, religious, cultural, ethnic, and otherwise. I have been struck by their shared passion and commitment to making their communities better. This kind of unity through diversity is what civil society is about. I believe that these individuals and the hundreds of thousands of people like them are the reason for many of the positive attributes that are enjoyed in this country. The UK truly should consider its civil society a national treasure. I appreciate that the government has made efforts to address some of the recommendations I made 3 years ago. However, my impression at the conclusion of this visit is that a series of separate measures by the government, some implemented and others proposed, are resulting in the closing of space for civil society. I'm concerned that put together, these measures suggest that government has a negative view of civil society as a critical partner that can and should hold government accountable. These moves have not always made headlines, and in many instances, they have been subtle and gradual, but they are as unmistakable as they are alarming. Allow me to address a number of specific areas of concern, all of which will be covered more comprehensively in my report to the Human Rights Council in June 2017. Freedom of association, countering terrorism and extremism. In my 2013 report, I expressed concern that the definition of domestic extremism was too broad and that peaceful protesters feared they could be easily grouped in this category alongside real and violent extremists. From my discussions with civil society and government during this visit, I do not believe enough has been done to alleviate this concern. The major issue today, it seems, is the government's focus on countering non-violent extremism without a narrow and explicit definition. The concerns raised by a number of interlocutors on certain aspects of the PREVENT strategy are illustrative. PREVENT focuses on individuals and groups that appear contrary to the British values of democracy, pluralism, and tolerance, and who are seen as being predisposed to respond to terrorist ideologies. The feedback from civil society on the impact of the PREVENT strategy was overwhelmingly negative. Students, activists, and members of faith-based organizations related countless anecdotes of the program being implemented in a way that translates simply into crude racial, ideological, cultural, and religious profiling, with consequent effects on the right to freedom of association of some groups. For example, the duty imposed on certain categories of public officials, including teachers, to observe, record, and report individuals they may consider extremists has led to restrictions on student union activities and the singling out of students from minority communities. Environmentalists, anti-capitalist groups, and some members of parliament have reportedly been provided as examples of extremists in PREVENT trainings. This lack of definitional clarity, combined with the encouragement of people to report suspicious activity, have created an ease and uncertainty around what can legitimately be discussed in public. I heard reports of teachers being reported for innocuous comments in class, for example. The specter of Big Brother is so large, in fact, that I was informed that some families are afraid of even discussing the negative effects of terrorism in their own homes, fearing that their children would talk about it at school and have their intentions misconstrued. It appears that PREVENT is having the opposite of its intended effect. By dividing, stigmatizing, and alienating segments of the population, PREVENT could end up promoting extremism rather than countering it. Even more disturbingly, the government is considering using some aspects of the PREVENT nonviolent extremism framework as a model for its forthcoming counter-extremism bill. For example, the bill reportedly may authorize the issuance of civil orders to ban nonviolent extremist groups, defined in vague terms open to arbitrary interpretation. I urge the government to carefully consider the negative unintended consequence of such provisions. It is difficult to define the term nonviolent extremist without treading into the territory of policing thought and opinion. Innocent individuals will be targeted. Many more will fear they may be targeted, whether because of their skin color, religion, or political persuasion, and be fearful of exercising their rights. Both outcomes are unacceptable. It is the duty of the government, and indeed all states, to do all it can to prevent, limit, and mitigate potential terrorist attacks that could arise from extremism. But I believe that the existing legal framework is robust enough to deal with any issues of terror, extremism, and related intolerance that could give rise to terrorism. Similarly, as I noted in my 2013 report, Muslim organizations and charities operating in countries deemed sensitive face serious difficulties in transferring and spending funds. The Charity Commission informed me that charities are provided guidance to help them in identify and mitigate risks of abuse for extremist purposes or terrorism financing. The Charity Commission is also working with sections of government and the banking sector to raise concerns about the impact of de-risking and debanking on the sector. I would urge all agencies concerned to do more to ensure that charities and other groups are not subjected to de-risking or debanking where there are other options of mitigating or managing risk. Charities that work in high-risk areas often serve the most vulnerable and desperate, often doing what governments ask of them. De-risking has serious consequences, not just on the rights of association of charities, but also on the rights of their beneficiaries. Moreover, it is in the government's interest, in the name of public safety, to keep charities within the official banking system and not push them into the underground economy. Furthermore, I remain concerned about the Investigatory Powers Bill, particularly the provisions of internet surveillance and thematic warrants. These are strong powers that, if not exercised with restraint, could have a grave impact on the rights to freedom of peaceful assembly and association. I urge the government to proceed cautiously in this area. Anti-lobbying and anti-advocacy clauses. The Transparency in Lobbying, Non-Party Campaigning and Trade Union Administration Act, or the Lobbying Act, has had a chilling effect on the work of charities during election periods, with many opting for silence on the issues they work on. The Act requires campaigners, including charities, to register with the Electoral Commission if their spending during an election period passes a certain threshold and if their activities could be perceived as intended to influence how people vote. Charities were reluctant to register, fearing that this would be misunderstood as engaging in prohibited party political activity. The recent announcement that a new clause will be inserted in all new and renewed government grant agreements, prohibiting these funds from being used to lobby government, has also caused confusion and uncertainty within the sector. It is far from clear what mischief the clause intends to address, or what activities are envisioned as constituting influence or attempting to influence government. But it is clear that this is being read by charities as an additional effort to further silence them if they receive government funds. I was informed by the Cabinet Office that they're currently consulting on this clause, and it is my hope that a thorough and open examination of the clause and its impact is carried out. The Charity Commission's guidance for charities ahead of the EU referendum was also described as confusing by members of civil society that I spoke to. Taken together, these developments have had the effect of charities refraining from engaging in activities they normally would, especially when their engagement is most needed, such as during elections or the referendum. Beyond the UK's borders, these measures are likely to have serious ramifications if adopted by less democratic states whose intention is to repress civil society. As mentioned earlier, the UK is regarded as a model in democracy and human rights and actively works at the Human Rights Council at the UN to support efforts for broader enabling environments for civil society. It is imperative that the same standards that the UK calls for internationally on civil society space are implemented domestically. trade unions. My major concern in the area of labor rights centers on the trade union bill, which is now in parliament with the deadline for passage of 19th May. The International Labor Organization issued a report last February highlighting a number of serious issues with the bill. I share these concerns and understand that some of them have been addressed, but many obstacles remain. Chief among them are the new threshold requirements regarding industrial action by unions in important public services. As it stands, the bill would require that 50% of members turn out to vote on industrial action and that at least 40% of the entire membership, assuming the 50% minimum turnout is met, votes in favor of the action. The government has suggested that this requirement is necessary because industrial actions have an impact upon wider society beyond workers and employers. They frame it as a more democratic approach. I see it as the opposite. It is profoundly undemocratic. Anyone who doubts this should ask themselves how they would feel if similar requirements were imposed for the UK general elections. Would it also be more democratic if the government required a 50% turnout of voters and 40% approval of all the eligible voters in order for the results of the upcoming EU referendum to be valid? The logic behind this requirement is disingenuous. There are other provisions with the bill as well. Provisions which allow the replacement of some striking workers, provisions which restrict picketing in a way that ordinary peaceful assemblies are not restricted, and restrictions on electronic voting. The fate of this bill will be decided well before I submit my final report to the Human Rights Council next year. But let me say this. It is clear that unions and a sizable portion of the public are very upset by the bill. Meanwhile, the government itself informed me that it was rushed to Parliament last year and that extensive litigation over various provisions is likely. I find this vexing because the process of drafting legislation should be a meticulous one, where time is taken to ensure both inclusiveness and clarity. The process surrounding the trade union bill seems to be taking the opposite approach. Sometimes when you do not get it right, it is better to step back and start from scratch. Turning to freedom of peaceful assembly, and first is undercover policing. I welcome the ongoing public inquiry on the use of undercover policing following my recommendation in 2013. Undercover policing certainly serves a vital function in gathering intelligence among criminal groups such as terrorists and violent gangs. However, its use against protest movements, leftist groups, and so on, which exercise their legitimate rights to dissent and freely assemble, is not justifiable. In order for this inquiry to be truly meaningful, it should not be shrouded in secrecy, especially in relation to undercover policing of protest groups. This would negate the very purpose of the exercise, and I note that the statement of the Home Office that it does not support a blanket restriction on disclosure in this regard. It is crucial that the views of the victims, rather than those of the police, are given priority in this inquiry. I call on the authorities to release the undercover identities of all officers who spied on peaceful activists. Victims have a right to know that they were wrongfully spied on, how intelligence collected may still be disrupting their lives, and if they were convicted, whether they may be able to overturn that conviction. This dark episode in the UK's history has caused profound damage to the victims, to people's comfort with exercising their assembly and association rights, and in many cases for the officers who are called upon to be spies. This damage can partly be remedied by imposing real accountability and transparency for the victims. I note the statement of the police that since 2013, they have tightened up procedures for authorizing undercover policing and that the related oversight mechanism has been strengthened. This should translate now to mean that the police will no longer deploy undercover officers within non-violent activist groups. Other issues: in a number of instances, the police have continued to use force against protesters in an excessive manner. The Greater Manchester Police, for example, reportedly took violent action against anti-fracking protesters at the Barton Moss camp from November 2013 to April 2014. The College of Policing's Code of Ethics, a laudable initiative which refers to the use of force, among other principles and standards of professional behavior for the police, should be abided by. I further urge them to read the joint report I presented to the UN Human Rights Council last month with Christoph Haynes, Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Executions. The report, which is a compilation of practical recommendations for the proper management of assemblies, contains a number of recommendations that are of particular relevance to this situation. I note with satisfaction that the Protest Liaison Officers Programme has been instrumental in ensuring the smooth running of many protests. There is indeed great value in ensuring open and conducive dialogue between protesters and the police. I remain concerned, however, about striking a balance between these liaison functions and the officer's duty to gather intelligence on protests, which, if not carefully managed, may erode trust. My attention has also been drawn to the alleged collusion between law enforcement authorities and private companies in the context of protests against businesses. I was informed that protesters have been arrested, forced to provide their names and addresses, and then found their names as targets of injunctions by the companies against further protest activity. This was, for instance, the case in relation to the No Dash for Gas protest at a gas power station in 2014 and at some anti-fracking protests. I find this alleged practice troubling and fail to see its legal justification. I also heard allegations that the police have continued to resort on several occasions to mass arrests and stop and search powers in the context of protests, most notably anti-fracking demonstrations, with a view to gathering intelligence on protesters. I want to underscore the chilling effect of such practice among protesters. In conclusion, I would like to reiterate my appreciation for the renewed excellent cooperation I received during this visit. I offer these observations and recommendations once again in a spirit of constructive dialogue. I look forward to continued dialogue with the British government, and I stand ready to offer technical assistance with a view to consolidating the exercise of the rights to freedom of peaceful assembly and of association in this country. Thank you very much. Any questions? We'll take some questions. Easy ones, please.
Great, good afternoon, Sam. Can I please clarify on the trade union bill? Are you calling for it to be scrapped in its entirety? That's what it seems to be suggesting. And just secondly, if I may, on your issues of other concern, I noticed that you didn't include the potential for European exit from the European Union, but I wondered if you would see that as a potential issue of concern with regards to human rights in this country.
Let me start with the last one, because I'm covering freedom of assembly and association. And in the context of the exit from the EU, that really doesn't have much relationship with freedom of association and assembly. I think that is whatever you decide is what you decide, as long as you maintain and protect the rights of assembly and association. There are many countries in the world that are not members of the EU and have the same obligations to protect these rights, and that continues whether Britain is a member or not. So that's not something I'm covering in the context of that. It's a bit different when you talk about the European Court of Human Rights, because generally speaking, I think the European Court has established jurisprudence and established a practice of a lot of respect for human rights. And that might be a bit of concern depending upon what replaces it or what happens. So I'm also aware that these two are very different debates, and so I don't want to put them together. But in terms of the exit, it's not my area of focus at all. I think that's your choice as Britain to decide what you want to do on that. It's you, whatever you decide, as long as you maintain the rights. Because, there are many countries in the world that are members of the EU and still respect rights. On the trade union bill, my view is that I think a lot more discussion should happen. I think that some of the provisions are dangerous. The voting threshold, as I said, is a particularly unnerving one in terms of making it so high and so hard. And in my discussions with government on this, it was expressed to me that the junior doctor strike, for example, has met the threshold in a way. But then if you take so much time to meet the threshold, but still after you go on strike, you take action and there's no resolution, then it makes it doubly difficult. So you have a very high threshold to meet before you take action. You take action and there's no resolution to it. It doesn't make much sense. So it's just making it harder for people to take action. And I think it's the inconsistencies as well that I'm worried about. As I mentioned, that it really does help to have one standard. If you can have a standard for voting and for action on trade unions and taking industrial action, why is that not also used for the EU referendum, for example? That 50% turnout, and then of that 50% turnout, 40% of the entire voting population, which makes it very, very difficult to actually move on anything. So it's just the consistency that I'm worried about. And that these moves may be being put in to restrict the right of association of unions and workers. There are many other provisions. And as I said, this is not my final report. I'm going to look way more in depth on these things before you know, for my report. In fact, some of these things that are coming up this year, I will be sending recommendations, very much, much more detailed recommendations to the government before my report is done in June next year. Yeah? Good.
Damien Gale from The Guardian. I noticed this time you didn't mention anything to do with intelligence databases on peaceful protesters. I wonder if you've had any discussions with the government about that and civil society groups.
Yes, we did. I think the concern remains. Again, this is just, as I said, it's just a very brief statement. We had concern. The concerns remain. As I said, there has been some implementation of some of the recommendations. There's still some discussions around the CAT case and what that means to the data collection, the CAT case, which the Supreme Court overturned the ruling. And I understand there's going to be an appeal to the European Court on that case. So we're following that, and that's going to, of course, influence how we see it. But I was supportive of the original decision before it was overturned by the Supreme Court. So, and that still remains. I think it does not help when government can keep intelligence as long as they do, and when you go to a protest, there's intelligence gathering on you on that. It just makes it harder. Now, I understand and I appreciate that police have to police, you know. But I think the first priority, and this is a report that we released in March at the Human Rights Council on a compilation of good practices and recommendations on managing protests. One of the first things we say is actually the first duty of the state is to facilitate the exercise of rights and then maintaining law and order and other things. But that's the first priority of states, is to make sure that people in a country can exercise their rights. And in this case, then anything that counters that or restricts that or makes people a little more nervous to exercise the right is then violating international human rights law. Okay. But it's still an issue of concern. I mean, I spent quite a bit of time on the undercover policing, which I found, which I'm very glad is happening. When I was here in 2013, the Home Secretary told me that she would not have a judicial inquiry. But I see that somebody managed to convince her and between then and now, so that's great. So I'm very happy, and now she seems very enthusiastic, which is very good. It's very, very good. So it's good people change their minds sometimes. Yeah. So I hope that inquiry is good. I think I had a long discussion with the police about their views and about secrecy. They want to maintain secrecy, and they want to keep the identities of the undercover police secret. But I still believe very much that this inquiry is in effect acting as a truth commission around that period. And it's so important, if you look at it in that context, that victims are given primary consideration. And if victims want, that's the first thing, that's the most important thing. I think many people are still not clear how extensive this undercover policing was. And I'm not talking about undercover policing on terrorism and on gangs. That's a different thing entirely. But I think it's a tool, whether we like it or not, that police use to be able to investigate. But on protest groups that are legitimately trying to exercise their rights, and the fact that people who were seen as outside the mainstream were the ones who were infiltrated. And this is not just protest groups, but also politicians and people. And when I talked to some people, they said, include these people who are seen as far left or far right. And it does, I mean, as long as people are peaceful and their intention is peaceful. Now, if there could be individuals in any institution, including The Guardian or The Sun, who are criminals, but that doesn't give anybody the right then to infiltrate the entire newspaper and say, because a few people are criminals, therefore we'll infiltrate them and then stay in for 5, 6, 7, 8 years. That's not proper policing, is not not appropriate use of resources, but also has a chilling effect on everybody, and you're not sure who to trust. I think the impact of that period from 1968 until it was stopped maybe 2008 or 2011 or whenever it is, around groups, has had a really, really disastrous impact on people's trust within some of these groups. You know, never sure who you can trust. And the government's role has to be to facilitate people enjoying their rights. And when you come into the era of the issue of sexual relationships and that were ongoing, the fact that a state can actually allow people to go and abuse people and trick them and deceive them in that way is utterly unconscionable. and I think that the issue deserves airing in a truth commission style approach. Yeah. And the other thing I want to mention, I think, and it's good because RT is here, I think it's important to emphasize that that what happens in Britain has a lot of resonance across the world. Now, what I have seen, and as I have done this mandate over the last 5 years, is oftentimes, you know, the positive things that are done in Britain or country as old as this may not receive as much attention as the negative things. And so what you get is when the world starts thinking there is retrogression in terms of human rights and democracy. That has a profound impact. And you find way less open societies using that as an example. Oh, it's happening in Britain. Britain is restricting this, so why can't we? And that becomes difficult. And I think one of the things we're urging the government here is to live up to its international calls for more space for civil society here domestically. It seems to be a little, there is a disconnect, it seems, to what Britain is saying at the UN Human Rights Council and to what it's trying to do here. I think that's an important part of, it's important that it keeps that same consistency. Its respect and its soft power will then increase. Any other question? Some questions were sent early on, is that true, Jeff? Some questions were asked by before?
I didn't receive any directly.
Okay. We got some on Twitter, there's some Twitter questions.
Not from media.
Okay. Not from media?
Not from media.
Okay. Well, there was just the whole, there was some asked about the far right protests, is that correct?
Through social media.
Yeah. What was the question, do you remember?
Just asking whether you would be as enthusiastic in defending the rights of far right wing groups as others.
Absolutely. And the answer to that is absolutely. I think freedom of assembly and association are not content rights, they are process rights. And the process is what's important. We don't look at the content unless the content meets the restrictions under international law. And they're very clear. And I think Article 20 of the ICCPR, International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, says that any advocacy of national, racial, or religious hatred that constitutes incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence shall be prohibited by law. So if the far-right groups are not heading there, they have every right, or even far left, even, or middle, or up left, or high left, or north left, whatever you want to call it. The point is that assembly rights are process rights, and that's no one should be. The government and the state should not be in the business of adjudicating what is right and what's wrong, as long as they meet the requirements of international law. That's the criteria. I think the idea is that we have a marketplace of ideas for all of us to be able to judge as rational human beings what is right and what's wrong. Yes?
Since no one else has got any questions, I also wondered if perhaps you comment on, and we've spoken about databases that take in peaceful protesters, but news has broken in the past few days that the British surveillance state is far more far-reaching than we even realised before. And I wondered if you think that this has implications for freedom of association, or anything they might be.
I haven't seen that information, but I think there's a real issue going on internationally. It's not just in Britain about surveillance and information given that the state is taking about us, each of us, without our permission necessarily, but just taking and using. I think that, you know, freedom of association, especially, and of assembly, but thrive on a sense of confidence that what you're doing, you know, if you're doing it, if you're using it peacefully and for the right reasons, that you're doing it legitimately. And that the state is not only prohibiting you from doing so, but is facilitating the exercise of these rights. So yes, when you have a sense that there's spying going on at every corner, that you don't know who's a spy, I mean, it almost goes back to the communist days of in the Soviet Union, you know, who's a spy, who's an informer, and that's not a way anybody would want to live. I think we are looking for more open societies. We are conscious of the fact that the world is not is not where it was in 1995, for example, but they are the new threats. But I think that these new threats may not even be that new. I think we've gone through the terrorism eras in Europe, especially, has seen massive terrorism in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that was going on, managed to handle that by retaining an open society. I think that so I think the challenge is how we address the threat of terrorism without restricting people. Because I think there's one wonderful saying that security without justice is a false security. And so it's important we marry those two objectives of, because none of us wants to live in a country where you're not sure when the next bomb is going to fly off, but nevertheless, on the other hand, you don't want to live in a country where you have to look over your back and not sure what you're going to say because you don't know how it's going to be used. So it's the whole transparency of information and the privacy issues are crucial. I mean, I think we need the privacy. It is our right to have the privacy. In fact, as recognition of that, as you know, the UN has created a new mandate on a special rapporteur on privacy, just be able to push that as much as possible. So it's a significant issue that we all should worry about. But you know, I think it's the less privacy we have, I think the less enjoyment of rights we've got. I think that has been tested as well through history. That when the state is overbearing, then suddenly it almost always leads to less and less rights. Good. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
Hope it's useful.